You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
At the last sentence in your opening commentary, that if the United States government could treat Hong Kong as if it were just another Chinese city, Hong Kong would be better off. I'm not quite sure what you meant by that. I might have heard you wrong. I don't think I did. But could you explain what that would mean and how that would be better for Hong Kong?
Sure. You did mishear me, or more likely I misspoke, in the sense that the history of the concept of just another Chinese city is how Hong Kong is treated by the mainland. And the notion is that, in my mind, perhaps a bit too facetiously, but still there is some import to it, it seems to me. Hong Kong is discriminated against, in a sense, under the one country, two systems arrangement, in that it, while it has many, many benefits that many others on the mainland would be jealous of, and it is part of the resentment that exists, is this jealousy of Hong Kong being treated so well politically, especially. But it doesn't have access to the budget process and some of the benefits of being just another Chinese city. And given that balance of economic and political benefits, if you start to take away some of the political benefits, then those economic costs of being an SAR start to shine through a bit. But it was mainland treatment of Hong Kong. But on the larger question, I'm not sure that there is a difference between us. I simply didn't address it much. I mean, I do think that the U.S. treatment of the Hong Kong issue and the larger promotion of universal values, the various political rights that are embodied in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the UN Covenants, there's no lack of enthusiasm on my part for keeping those front and center. I think we do have to take that with a short, medium, and long-term perspective and be realistic about how much leverage we have and what we can achieve over time. Better than I do, given your expertise, what it'll take for political reform to gradually happen on the mainland. I do think that's a long-term prospect, and one that we can only do so much to drive from the outside without encountering some, not just headwinds, but some counterproductive effects.
Thanks, Harry, for your question. There was a hand up back here.
Thank you, Richard. It's Shirley Lin from Chinese University of Hong Kong. Hi. I'm a Hong Konger and a Taiwanese, so I wanted to draw back to your excellent chapter in the book about Taiwan, and if you could expand more on it, because in your talk you also alluded to the fact that the Taiwanese have not been interested in one country, two system ever, and now Hong Kong is a good example of why they shouldn't be. And I wanted to get back to what you said, which is basically that Beijing certainly doesn't think so. So Beijing has a different perspective than what the Taiwanese think about the connection between Hong Kong and Taiwan. I wanted to ask about it, especially because you talked about the millennials, and I think you're right that Beijing does not understand what the millennials, or at least don't care about what the millennials in Taiwan and Hong Kong think, because they are making it very plain and obvious with the rise of localism. But I'm asking this to derive some optimism from your book, but it was hard to find. But to expand on your third option, could you tell us the possibility that Beijing would look at the third option and liberalize, thinking that this is one, if they were to do so, of course, with a slim chance, Hong Kong would be a great example of how Taiwan also could be unified. Could you talk a little bit about that, and especially because I think the millennials in China actually do not appreciate the problems that Hong Kong and Taiwanese millennials have. As you know, in Hong Kong, we have a huge polarized population between mainland Chinese students and Hong Kong students.
Okay. A lot of questions there. I do think that if Beijing had played electoral reform more skillfully, and if the whole process had succeeded, it might have led some people in Taiwan to think twice about demonstration effect and the trends for Hong Kong and the whole approach of one country, two systems. It doesn't answer all the concerns that Taiwan people would have, and the two are different. I think it would have at least given Taiwan people something to think about. One of the problems in getting to my scenario three of pleasant surprise is, I think, the nature of the Chinese system and how leaders have problems defined for them. Xi Jinping, as far as I know, doesn't go down to Hong Kong and look around and talk to students and others. There's a vast flow of information that comes up to him and structures the way he thinks about his government's options in the context of how he defines its interests. I suspect that the information that top leaders are getting is, shall we say, flawed, and that the all the people who sort of pushing this idea of the U.S. black hand and a Taiwan black hand, those views don't get properly questioned and dismissed. If you're presented with a very negative trend view of the trend in Hong Kong, you're less likely to be thinking about a radically new approach. I hope I'm wrong. I don't think I'm wrong. Back in the early 80s, it was hard to be optimistic about the future of political reform in Taiwan. And then all of a sudden, one guy changed his mind in a rather counterintuitive way, and it was President Zhang Jinghuo, and we see the result of that today. I think the attachment to one country, two systems is very much generational. And for people who were living and politically conscious when this whole idea was sort of formulated and deployed, it was something that one sort of took in and mastered. As time has gone on, there's a lot of distance between today and the environment of that time. Younger people are not socialized, so we say, into the importance of one country, two systems. I think at the same time, leaders in China have not been prepared to understand the way the world has changed and how this formula that seemed good in the early 1980s might not apply anymore. One of my favorite lines in the Basic Law has to do with circumstances under which universal suffrage will be the principle for chief executive elections and legco elections. It is that reform will occur based on the actual situation in Hong Kong and according to the principle of gradually and orderly progress. Well, surprise, surprise, the actual situation in Hong Kong has changed. It's a very different place from what it was, and I'm not sure mainland leaders have totally caught up with that. I think that in Hong Kong, you can't have gradual and orderly progress at the same time. You can have gradual, but it's not going to be orderly. You can have orderly, but it has to be fast. That contradiction has not sort of seeped into the consciousness. So, please.
May I add a footnote, just so that I'm not, leaving you with the impression that I'm a pessimist on this completely. I think there is an optimist argument, and it is, again, returning to the economics. The same thing that made Hong Kong relevant and made statesmen argue on behalf of it when they didn't have to if they were outside the British system was the economics. And I think that'll happen again in this respect. It's exactly what Richard was saying. Just a footnote to that is it's not one country, two systems that I think that will persuade Beijing that it needs to invest in Hong Kong for Taiwan, but rather the potential for negative economic outcomes. So while success in Hong Kong may only get you marginal progress with the Taiwan side, economic failure in Hong Kong, I think, is to be avoided, even if it...